Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Right now, Sagar's recording our crossover episode of Andrew Yang's podcast that's going to come out next Tuesday. So today, I'm flying solo. As we promised, we're going to keep doing these Thursday episodes, and we'd like to use the opportunity to go way deeper into the different topics we speak about on the podcast. As one of our very unfriendly iTunes reviewers, SwaggyMan3000, pointed out, sometimes Sagar and I have a little too much fun, and we just sort of label those who disagree with us as neoliberals, and then we call it a day. The issues we focus on are actually really complicated, so any chance we get to actually help you all as listeners think about the word a little deeper is actually a huge win for us. So for today's episode, I'm speaking with Jacob Hellberg. Jacob Hellberg is a senior advisor at the Stanford University Program on Geopolitics and Technology, and he's also an adjunct fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He previously worked at Google on news policy. If you enjoy this conversation about China, TikTok, industrial policy, the way we could sort of bring jobs back home after COVID, he's working on a book that's going to deal with all these issues related to technology and national security. So today we're going to pause on realignment questions, but if you have anything you'd like to ask next week or for our upcoming Q&A shows, email us at realignmentpod@gmo.com with a screenshot of a 5-star review or leave a question in the review itself. We'd also appreciate it if you just scroll to the bottom of the podcast page on Apple and drop us a 5-star rating if you haven't yet. Like we said on Tuesday, we're going for 1,000 ratings and reviews by November, and we will give it a rest after we get to that point. And last but not least, a quick shout out to The Realignment's host, the Lincoln Network. And I want to emphasize this because we've gotten a number of angry emails and tweets. We're sponsored by the Lincoln Network, not the Lincoln Project, the anti-Trump campaign group. But I will say, speaking of crossover episodes, it would be fun to do one of the Lincoln Project if they're at all willing. Lincoln Network, our actual sponsor, focuses on exploring the gap between Silicon Valley and DC. And as you'll see in today's episode, everything we talk about, whether it's the prospect of bringing jobs back to the US or the debate over TikTok, is really centered on technology and the different conflicts between the East Coast and the West Coast that we repeatedly have hit in a bunch of different episodes this season. Now, on to the interview. Jacob Hellberg, welcome to The Realignment.
Marshall, thanks for having me.
So there's a lot we're going to hit today. We're going to talk about China, the US, the sort of the debate over whether there's a new Cold War, TikTok, bringing jobs back. But the thing I want to sort of start with, you have a really interesting background. What got you into China and tech policy?
I spent a lot of my time at Google focused on addressing challenges that span from foreign interference to disinformation and what some people at Google called information integrity. And during that time, I saw the tech industry really caught in the crosshairs of a new geopolitical landscape where governments view technology companies as both proxies and targets of their respective national power. I then briefly worked on Project Dragonfly for a few months before it was leaked to The Intercept, and which gave me a window to emerging issues with the one company, two systems model, which I recently wrote about in an article in Foreign Policy. At the time, I remember telling to one of my colleagues that the approach essentially amounted to piloting a one company, two systems model. And I was very skeptical of that approach, that it would be sustainable. I had my own personal moral reservations about the project, but I obviously understood the well-intentioned arguments for wanting to have a presence in the world's largest internet market. Ultimately, as history panned out, the experience forever convinced me that the approach is not sustainable. And most recently, I joined Stanford University's program on geopolitics and technology, where I've been working on a book that's at the nexus of national security, China, and technology policy.
Great. And just to clarify, what was, I know you can't go too into the details, but what was Project Dragonfly?
Project Dragonfly was allegedly a project aimed at allowing Google to provide search services pertaining to news information in China in a manner that conformed with Chinese laws.
So Google basically hasn't been in China for what? Has it been around 8-10 years now? Or
right, since 2010, 2011.
Great. So, well, not great. That's obviously a complicated issue. But to the actual sort of topic, part of the reason why we wanted to talk with you about this China issue is that there's going to be a lot of debate in either 2021 or 2024, whenever President Trump leaves office, over what were these sort of Trumpian issues or these sort of policy topics that were sort of the moment, and what are ones that are truly going to last deeper into the century, really going to matter. And I think something I truly believe, and I suspect you agree with too, is that China is definitely that issue. So what do you think is the core issue that's driving sort of the brewing talk of a Cold War between the US and China?
Well, Marshall, I wish we could confidently sit here and say that the CCP was at peace with itself and with the world. I think the fact that that the answer to that is becoming overwhelmingly clear is the core issue that's going to be animating our foreign policy debates for many years to come. I genuinely wish we could say confidently that although China and the United States have differences, that our two countries could find common ground to work together on solving global challenges that affect our planet and both of our people. But I think today we're all realizing that, as President Obama once eloquently said, it's important that we face the world as it is, not as we wish it were. And those that say that we're not in a Cold War simply haven't been paying attention. They haven't been paying attention to the willful, lethal export of fentanyl to our country. They haven't been paying attention to the rampant theft of intellectual property affecting our companies. They haven't been paying attention to the undermining of democracy around the world, or to the military intrusions in other countries like India, or even to the recent revelations of genocide against Uyghurs, which Vice President Biden very strongly denounced just a few days ago. We need to be honest with ourselves about the fact that the peace that we have been engaged with China over a number of years has been, as Orwell once put it, a peace that's not really a peace. So the question today is, at what point do we start pushing back as a country? How many more fatalities from fentanyl is it going to take? Or how many more billions in intellectual property stolen from American companies is it going to take? How many more innocent Uyghurs will need to be arbitrarily in prison and in concentration camps? When do we start to defend our people, our companies, and our values? Those are the key questions that I think people are going to debate in years to come. And those that religiously cling to a bygone status quo are embracing a peace that's conditioned on America abdicating a lot of its core interests. So and that's not a diplomatic achievement.
Mm-hmm. No, go on. Yeah.
I was going to say, I don't think that's a diplomatic achievement to write home about. I think our country has proven before that we can do much better than settle for a policy of managed decline in the face of what's increasingly taking shape as an existential threat to democracies.
So what's interesting about your background is obviously you're a Democrat. This podcast, while, you know, nonpartisan, is obviously sort of center right. How do you think this debate has sort of shaped up within the Democratic Party, and to the point where now, where you, I think, can confidently say there is sort of this bipartisan consensus on the issue, but that definitely doesn't feel like this was an issue that Democrats or, frankly, establishment Republicans were particularly engaged with, you know, over the past several years?
I think the cleavage isn't so much between Democrats and Republicans. It's really more between one of the biggest divides in the foreign policy community at its root is about whether or not the U.S. has the capacity to lead a vibrant and strong liberal world order. I think that cleavage often tends to be generational. You have those foreign policy thinkers on the one hand that will essentially argue that the U.S. does not have the capacity to prevent China from revising the world order to its authoritarian image, and therefore the U.S. should basically cut its losses by accommodating China rather than stopping it, rather than try stopping it. And then you have those that look at Beijing's deepening authoritarianism with a profound sense of concern over the genocide that the CCP is committing against its own people, as well as the CCP's global ambitions. And those people often tend to conclude that democracies don't really have a choice but to push back on China's revisionism, and that it should be U.S. policy to reinvigorate democratic ascendancy in this century. I find myself personally decidedly in the camp of those that favor standing firm to the CCP's dystopian vision of the future, and I believe that the United States has the capacity to lead.
So before we move on, I want to hit sort of 2 points. One, can you sort of defend the articulation of the post-World War II world order from, I think, populist critiques of the left and the right? I think the right would say, especially post-Trump, that this world order involved the U.S. spending blood on treasure, on allies that weren't in any way loyal. It revolved around, you know, exporting jobs overseas, you know, the sort of basic critique there. And the left would also say that this U.S. world order, as embodied by instances such as the Vietnam War, was actually quite bloody and wasn't actually something that was good. And I think both of those two critiques are unified by this idea that the American people themselves probably didn't exactly sign up to defend that order, especially after the Soviet Union fell. So could you just sort of articulate that? Because that's another generational issue that I think is very important.
Well, I think there's two important points to make in the defense of the global liberal order. And the first is that I think a key strategic mistake that as a country we've made over the last few years has been to decouple and de-link our economic and trade policies from our national security priorities. Throughout the thrust of the Cold War, we had a pretty close alignment of our foreign economic agenda with our national security priorities, as has been talked about and litigated in the academic press at length. We didn't do much business with the Soviet Union because it was not in our national security interest to do so. In ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall, we essentially, there was this school of thought that if we just do business with the rest of the world, if a country has access to Starbucks and McDonald's, the fruits of capitalism will inevitably give rise to popular movements that will demand more democracy, and that as countries would become richer, they will want to become freer. That assumption proved to be a fundamental miscalculation and did not pan out in the world's most populous country. The second point that I would point out in the defense of world order is that I think leading the world does not mean leading it alone. And throughout most of the Cold War, the United States proved incredibly effective and successful when it had allies to organize the world in a way that was friendly for democratic principles, which include very tangible benefits to American society, like the protection of intellectual property, like the protection of free press, the ability for people to travel in countries without being arbitrarily arrested or spied on, or to do business in a lot of other countries in a way that creates jobs here in the United States. The tide has really begun to turn at the end of the Cold War, when some of our core assumptions started to change. For example, just since 2000, we lost 66,000 manufacturing plants in the United States just since in the last 20 years. This obviously came after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I think the strategy we had during the Cold War was really successful. I think the departure from that strategy proved to have some pretty profound mistakes embedded in some of our assumptions.
100%. And then the last part then is, can you help listeners just understand not only what would a sort of Chinese world order look like, but why is it actually something that's sort of bad? Why is it that something, you know, sort of imagine you're thinking of a 22, 23 year old who opposed the Iraq war, or doesn't really know why we were over there in the first place, doesn't remember September 11th, definitely doesn't remember the Soviet Union. Why does what China is doing in the South China Sea, or what Belt and Road is impacting Southeast Asia, why is that something that would matter to an America if it's trying to reconcile itself to a world that has increasing rising powers and isn't just sort of us dictating the rules like we did after World War II?
Well, at its core, I think this new geopolitical contest that we're in really boils down to a choice between competing visions of world order. And Tim Cook had a very eloquent phrasing for this in a speech at the Parliament when he said that it's about choosing what kind of world we want to live in. Do we want to live in a world where the internet is decentralized, free, and empowers ordinary people? Or do we want to live in a world where the internet is centralized, repressive, and essentially a tool of political control? When we look at China's ambitions around the world through its Belt and Road initiatives, and when we look at their growing efforts to push Huawei into other countries and their civil military fusion doctrine that essentially makes Huawei an extension of the Chinese state and an instrument of China's broader global political ambitions, I think it's deeply, deeply concerning to look at a future where there's a growing prospect for China to envelop other countries behind its Great Firewall. That means a potential erosion of American companies' ability to protect their intellectual property, the privacy of their users, and so forth, in vast swaths of the world where Huawei and as well as other commercial Chinese platforms are making significant headway. You brought up the Belt and Road Initiative. China has a whole of the state approach. They are using the Belt and Road Initiative in order to support the internationalization of their companies, including Huawei, including Alipay, Alibaba, and other companies like TikTok. Today, I think, you know, I live in Silicon Valley where tech companies, I think, are increasingly realizing that they're caught in the crosshairs between two profoundly contradictory visions of world order. And I think ultimately a lot of them are finding out that it's only a matter of time before they're forced to pick a side because both sides are completely irreconcilable from a first principle standpoint. And the last point I would add is that for a long time, China has led a lot of American companies to make short-term concessions in terms of engaging in joint ventures that entail the transfer of valuable intellectual property with the carrot of doing business in the Chinese market that allow companies to view the Chinese market as a short-term opportunity to increase revenue. I think companies are starting to catch on to the fact that that deal often ends up being very temporary and short-lived. And as soon as China sees that it's in its benefit to indigenize those technology capabilities within China, they foster their own domestic competitors, and American companies tend to be driven out of business. And ultimately, as I said earlier about China's whole of the state approach, they support their national champions to try to drive foreign competitors out of business elsewhere. So it's really in American businesses' long-term interest to actually support the U.S. government's efforts to have a broader geoeconomic strategy in tandem with allies to protect the liberal order and the rule of law that American companies rely on to operate in a fair and free market.
Yeah, and that's the interesting point, because this goes back to what you were saying earlier with if we look at the difference between the sort of Cold War era and today, the assumption post-Cold War wasn't that you wouldn't have to think about the U.S. government, right? The markets would largely not regulate themselves, but, you know, there's this massive Chinese market, and if you're a business, it's perfectly rational to sort of pursue that effort. So that's a big mental shift. So I get where the sort of difficulties come from. But this is a good pivot into the sort of juiciest and I think most relevant newsy part of the conversation, which is about TikTok, right? Because TikTok is obviously encapsulating every single one of these issues that you sort of brought up. The two countries, two systems, one company, two systems idea, the idea of, you know, domestic champions versus other countries' champions. So what is your position right now on TikTok? I think there are a couple options on the table. One is a ban, one is a forced sale, one is a maintenance of the status quo. How are you thinking about the topic?
So I believe that the status quo with TikTok simply doesn't make sense for America. And I formed that viewpoint for three main reasons. The first is that from a trade reciprocity standpoint, most US content platforms are today banned in China. There's Facebook, Twitter, GitHub, Google, YouTube, Reddit, Netflix. The list goes on and on, Marshall. Given that China's internet censorship discriminates against foreign companies, blocks the legitimate flow of services, and doesn't even offer a channel to appeal, I think there's a credible argument to be made that their firewall violates the spirit of several WTO rules that China itself agreed to when it joined the WTO back in 2001. So unlike some have suggested, demanding a basic level of trade reciprocity is actually not about replicating China's behavior, but it's about enforcing the spirit of international laws. The world isn't a blank canvas on which China should be given free rein to paint any one of its authoritarian ambitions. We have a system. That system has rules. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for democracies to enforce those rules. The second reason is that TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is believed to have helped the CCP with identifying Uyghur women of childbearing age to load them on trains, send them to concentration camps, where their heads were forcibly shaved bald and where they were forcibly underwent mass sterilization. As Joe Biden recently pointed out, and as the Trump administration recently said it was also considering, intentionally destroying in whole or in part an ethnic group is the textbook definition of genocide under UN conventions. And I think the United States should have absolutely no part in that. And the third reason, which is the key factor that you and I have been talking about in this conversation, and I suspect we'll examine a little bit more closely, it's the cybersecurity risk. And it's somewhat intractable under the status quo. China allowing TikTok to do business in the United States while having its engineering teams based in China essentially allows the Chinese government to impose its national security law and its national intelligence law on TikTok's engineering operations, which exposes the data of American users to potential surveillance by the CCP. And this gets at the legal contradictions of the one company, two systems model. And I think that the cybersecurity risks are pretty intractable under the status quo. So I think that the president, regardless of who's president and regardless of party, does have the authority under our current laws to either suspend TikTok's operations or force a divestment. In a perfect world, I would be in favor of a divestment so long as that divestment also was followed through with a reshoring of TikTok's engineering operations outside of China. I think the shutting down TikTok's operations in China is a necessary condition to actually solve the cybersecurity problems at hand.
So a couple follow. So I agree with all those things, but in the name of devil's advocacy, and whataboutism, I guess, basically, I'll ask a couple questions.
Sure.
So the first one would just be, why become, and these are questions that critics of this viewpoint that you and I hold have asked, which is, for example, why become more like China? So they would say, yes, you're right, Jacob, the Chinese do have this authoritarian vision of the internet that's very balkanized, that is very punitive, but by the U.S. engaging in this TikTok ban, divestiture, et cetera, we're simply adopting their methods. We're sort of, you know, engaged in a sort of race to the bottom there. So how do you respond to that critique?
Well, the response is, I think, is actually very clear. What sets the U.S. and as well as other democracies apart from China is not that our markets is completely unfettered and that their markets have rules. What sets democracies apart from China is that we are a democracy, our internet is democratic, and they are an autocracy with an authoritarian internet. And that is the substantive difference. Every country has rules. Germany has a hate speech law that applies to internet companies. I would say that that does not play, Germany passing a hate speech law does not play into China's quote-unquote cyber sovereignty model. Some of the same people that are against the U.S. government taking actions on grounds of national security are in fact also pushing for legislation forcing internet companies to take down so-called quote-unquote fake news. Would that count as cyber sovereignty? I don't support any of these initiatives that have been proposed to date, but of course it's not cyber sovereignty because China's internet is not about sovereignty. It's about authoritarianism and political control. And recently, Peter Thiel very astutely at an event, at a recent event, compared some of the things that China's been doing to the quote-unquote eye of Sauron that sees all things in all places at all times. And frankly, I think he hit the nail on the head. There's also something ironic about people making false equivalencies between the US government and the CCP using our uncensored platform and free press. And you know, Marshall, if some reporters and pundits in our raucous information environment don't always see the difference between a democratic internet and an authoritarian internet, I can guarantee you, as someone who's traveled to North Korea, that people in Taiwan, in Xinjiang, and in Hong Kong know exactly what the difference is.
Yeah, that's very helpful. So then the second thing is, what does the tick... So we're talking about Uyghurs. I've talked about Uyghurs before. Sagar, co-host who's not here, has talked about Uyghurs. But what does banning the domestic... Or what does sort of altering the domestic nature of TikTok's control actually to sort of affect that situation? Because I think people sort of compare the Uyghur cultural and literal genocide example when it comes to the sterilization issues to issues of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust pre-World War II. But in that case, American companies such as IBM, at least from my historical knowledge, were engaged in activities that literally themselves helped the Nazi state engage in its authoritarian program. So that seems to be a little different from, I think, if we're sort of talking about sort of pundits and reporters who have pushed back against this line of argument, TikTok is an app where people watch people dance. Banning or changing that app will have nothing to do with the situation with the Uyghurs. So what do you think about that argument?
I think that's based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the kinds of information that TikTok is actually collecting on people's devices. There's been engineers in Silicon Valley that have done a tremendous amount of fantastic technical work, reverse engineering what the app is actually collecting. And the information that they've come across, I think, is deeply concerning. I've heard the arguments that that basically argue, who cares if TikTok is collecting information about dancing videos? It's actually collecting people's GPS coordinates every 30 seconds. It's collecting people's clipboard data on and off the app on their cellular devices. That means that anything that you're copying and pasting on your cell phone is being collected by TikTok, even outside of the app. That, for a lot of people, includes people copying and pasting their email and passwords to various accounts like Dropbox or emails. There's a lot of sensitive data that has nothing to do with dancing videos that TikTok is being collected. There have been Indian... Go ahead.
No, please continue.
I was going to say there have been Indian analysts that have talked about during the border disputes, what if Indian soldiers had TikTok on their phones? That could have allowed the Chinese government to geolocate the positioning of Indian soldiers along the Sino-Indian border. So there are some real consequences on real geostrategic interests for the United States with allowing 50 million American devices to have Trojan malware installed with a window, opening a window into the lives of Americans.
So you're obviously very well traveled. I think the North Korean, hopefully we could do a whole show on that someday.
Sure.
Or hopefully that issue matters a whole lot less someday is the bigger priority. Yeah, hopefully it shouldn't be distinctive that you visited North Korea. But something that I think people struggle with is just a lack of deep knowledge about China and a lack of understanding of why it is that the Chinese are doing things that they do, which then in a weird way leads to sort of this orientalist sort of articulation of the Chinese Communist Party. And the example I'm sort of thinking of, and I sort of got this from reading Thomas Friedman columns growing up, which is that the Chinese, unlike the Americans, think hundreds of years in the future, and they're so, you know, very, very, very thoughtful and intellectual in comparison to our sort of short-termist system, which could have degrees of truth or falsity to that. But what I don't understand, and what I think a lot of listeners will understand, is why did the Chinese Communist Party decide to engage the way it did during the Trump year? Because real quick, I want to sort of offer an alternate vision of what they could have done. And they sort of started, Xi Jinping started to do this at the start of Trump's presidency, going to Davos and talking about how China was actually the best defender of the world order. China actually believes in engaging with issues such as climate change. Why didn't the CCP just pursue a very positive, short-term soft power campaign to contrast with sort of the downsides of Trumpist America, when in the real world, what they instead did was engage incredibly aggressively on the South China Sea issue. They were aggressive with the issues with Huawei, with the sort of data collection stuff, with ByteDance. And then you have the issue with India and the border disputes. Why is the sort of status quo reached this point?
Well, I think you're basically seeing a twofold dynamic play out, where on the one hand, you have the CCP's words, and on the other hand, you have the CCP's actions. And those two things look very, very different. You rightly pointed out that the year started with President Xi Jinping's grand statements in Davos about casting himself as the defender of the global system, which is obviously highly ironic given the fact that the global system vis-a-vis China has mainly been a one-way street. As you know, China's markets are basically have a lot of friction, not just for internet companies, but for a whole host of other industries. The global system, which traditionally also includes the free flow of ideas, is completely restricted in China. I mean, the list is, as we just said, very, very long. So there's an elephant in the room. There is an irony that's the size of an elephant in the room in Xi Jinping's speeches. Recently, the Chinese government has, different officials from the Chinese government have reasserted statements about, we don't want to be in a Cold War with the United States. We want a peaceful coexistence. But on the other hand, as you pointed out, when you look at their actions tell a very different story. And I think that fundamentally, that discrepancy basically boils down to a very common pattern throughout history of authoritarian governments trying to engage in psychological information operations as well as deception campaigns. I think it's purely strategic. They have, if you look at their actions, they've obviously launched an unprovoked attack against India. They have launched the biggest cyber attack against Australia, the biggest cyber attack in Australian history. They have launched a cyber attack against His Holiness the Pope. They have tried to hack hundreds of Western firms in search for the coronavirus vaccine. They've then, you know, tried to say, if we get the coronavirus vaccine first, we'll make it freely available as a global public good as our contribution to humanity, only to later say, actually, we might put strings attached to it. And if you criticize the CCP, you may not have access to the coronavirus vaccine that we developed. So there's this constant discrepancy between rhetoric and actions. And I think that that's why, from a policy planning standpoint, Western governments, as well as democracies at large, really ought to be looking closely at the actions of the CCP, much more than making decisions based off of their statements, because their statements have unfortunately often proven to be quite hollow.
Yeah, speaking of democracies, you did a really great appearance. I think it was with Venture Stories. I'll make sure I get that right. We'll include it in the show notes, where you were talking about confidence as an idea and talking about how India's decision to ban TikTok represented a assertion of confidence that you found admirable. Can you sort of speak to that idea? Because I think that the idea of confidence is one that I think a lot of us could sort of think more about.
Well, as we briefly touched upon at the beginning of this segment, I do think that we're seeing a bit of a crisis of confidence that is driving the split in the debate in our foreign policy community. On the one hand, there are foreign policy thinkers that believe that the U.S. today doesn't have the capacity to lead and therefore shouldn't even try. And on the other hand, there are those that would really like to see America be more confident, as well, and America as well as democracies, be more confident and comfortable with a starting assumption and premise that we should be focused on doing what's right for democracies and for our country, and we shouldn't be constantly so deterred to take actions like, for example, suspending TikTok based on hypothetical repercussions that we might face with Beijing. And I think that that crisis of confidence today is very reflective, is, I think, on the one part somewhat generational, but I think it's very reflective reflective of the policy cleavage that we're seeing in the foreign policy community.
So my last thing on this is, could you articulate what relationship slash status with the US you would like China to have? Because I'm thinking of very, very online, tanky, anti-US Twitter, what their sort of argument around this whole discussion is, look, Marshall and Jacob are talking about all these sort of specific instances, but if we take a step back, the broad issue here is that these guys are obsessed with maintaining the US control over the global commons, and they are just like the UK before World War I, who wasn't willing to let Germany or any other power rise. And at a core level, they just have an objection to a China that isn't subservient to colonialism. So I that's obviously not what either of us sort of believe, but I think we could do a better job as sort of a bipartisan policy community of articulating what it is that a more positive relationship looks like that also doesn't revolve around keeping the Chinese people down, because obviously the rise in living standards in the country has been a real human achievement and isn't one that I think anyone who's reasonable objects to.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, I think the people that say that the U.S. is simply trying to cling to global domination, quote unquote, at the risk of pain, recapping the caricature that people have about American intentions, I think simply doesn't match up to the facts. For 30 years, the United States has had a policy of very accommodative open engagement with China. We have had a policy of peaceful coexistence, of what a number of our past leaders have referred to as a peace, as being in favor of a peaceful rise. President Obama famously said that if dictators unclench their fists, they'll find an open hand from the United States. Obviously, I think it's fair to say that Xi Jinping would count as one of those dictators, which has had a very clenched fist for a number of years now. Unfortunately, China has not unclenched its fist. It's really doubled down on a much more authoritarian approach. And so I think it's only normal for the United States as well as democracies to take stock and to take inventory of where we stand today. China is a government that is committing genocide. And I think that should have a lot of serious implications for how we think about what our relationship with them should be. I think it's perfectly fine for the United States as well as democracies to engage with China on solving global issues that are in everyone's interest, like, for example, solving climate change, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, as well as potential arms control agreements, just like we did with the Soviet Union. But those, a policy of engaging on global issues should not be linked in any way to concessions that we make with respect to intellectual property, to fentanyl, to human rights. We should have a very clear double track approach where we don't cede an inch on any of the core issues that are fundamental to our interests, whether it's on any one of the issues that I just mentioned, while at the same time engaging with them on things that they should want to engage with us on because it's also in their interest. I mean, if oceans level rise and Shanghai finds itself underwater, that is fundamentally a Chinese problem as well as an American one. So they have every reason to want to engage with us on these issues. And there is no reason why the United States or any other country should accept making any concessions on human rights. For example, we shouldn't turn the other way on the genocide that they're committing on against their own people just because they agree to cut carbon emissions by a certain amount. They're not doing us a favor by making these types of agreements. They're really just working on something that's also in their own interest. So I think the relationship that I would view at this point being a healthy one is the free world coalescing on basic principles that are vital to their interests, like the protection of the rule of law, of basic democratic principles and democratic institutions, while at the same time allowing for some limited engagement on issues that are in everyone's interests. And it's important, and it's unfortunate, and I wish we hadn't gotten to this point, but I think the big conclusion is that making peace with China does not mean making friends with China. This is a regime that's committing genocide, and that should have consequences.
So for our last sort of bit here, you did a really great piece in Foreign Affairs talking about the debate over manufacturing and state involvement in that thing, when it comes to sort of the time after COVID. But the place where I sort of want to start is that this debate over China and jobs actually sort of goes to the start of the Trump campaign, not maybe sort of the presidency, this argument that America deindustrialized. You know, you cited it earlier, 66,000 factories closing since 2000. Is it possible at a baseline level to bring those jobs back if America has a different relationship with China?
Well, I think today the question isn't so much whether it's possible, but whether we can afford not to. And I think it's important to note that reshoring will require an extensive collaborative effort between the government and the private sector to, as a first step, take inventory of the products relevant to national security by first determining which high-tech and vital goods have to be produced domestically. Second, which can be safely sourced from allies and friendly democracies. And as a third bucket, which can still be imported from the global market, including from authoritarian states like China. I think carrying out a strategy, as I wrote in that article, and operationalizing it is going to take a lot of resources, but a few elements that I think stand out for a potential strategy include four basic building blocks. The first is we should develop a strategy to make sure that our companies have access to abundant and inexpensive supplies of raw materials that are needed to manufacture finished goods. That's what China has spent many years invested in doing in Africa. The United States can compete because a lot of the deals that China has cut with African governments have proven to be debt traps. And the United States, as well in tandem with allied countries, can engage with African countries through partnerships that are much more authentically empowering to the recipient governments. The second is we should foster the most innovative and productive workforce. And that will probably require reforming our immigration system, as well as ensuring that more people graduate with mechanical engineering degrees, not just software engineering degrees, as well as creating a very tactical training to address the so-called trade skills gap, which has left a lot of manufacturing roles unfilled today. I've seen this firsthand because I'm actually part of the Manufacturing Leadership Council at the National Association of Manufacturers. And the skills gap has been a key issue, like, for example, skills like operating machinery or welding. The third piece is I think a strategy will also mean investing in building regionally geographically concentrated hubs that yield network effects. Just like Silicon Valley, Hollywood, Motor City, or even Shenzhen for that matter. I think geographically concentrated hubs there is something very powerful about being able to make one good on one block. And if you need a slightly different modified version, there's a company that's three blocks down that will modify it for you. If you need an expert in something related to circuit boards, that there's another company five blocks away. In Silicon Valley, that geographic concentration has really created an ecosystem that has where you have incredibly talented, smart people that have a lot of institutional knowledge about incredibly technical issues. And I think that has very, very powerful network effects. And some of the most influential hubs in nearly every industry have some degree of geographic concentration. And I think the US should just embrace that. And the fourth is, I think, working to build some sort of allied industrial free trade area in collaboration with other democracies would help our companies wean themselves off their demand side dependence on the Chinese market. So obviously, if we ask a company like Apple to reshore its supply chains outside of China, which could mean that their goods might have a more expensive cost structure, we should think about how do we help our companies make sure that they have access to a market that is at least as large or ideally larger than China's in order to ensure that our companies will always be competitive from a scale standpoint and from a market cap standpoint to be competitive vis-a-vis their Chinese competitors.
I'm glad you brought up the network effects and the regional hubs debate because, as someone on Twitter, I'm sure you've seen the big debates about whether or not big cities like New York are done or whether or not the sort of post-COVID remote sort of future thing has made it so that centralization actually is no longer a valid advantage in the internet era. What do you think about that debate, especially in this context? Because it seems to me that everything you're suggesting is that there's actually still going to be plenty of huge niches, and there's still plenty of advantages that come from centralization in cities and like regions and stuff like that.
I've seen that debate, but having a lot of friends that in the venture capital community as well as in the startup founder community, and having followed some of the recently published academic research and literature, I can very confidently say that yes, there's been chatter about people just going completely remote, but at the same time, what we've seen throughout this pandemic is that morale and people's happiness and the fulfillment that people derive from their work in a work remote environment is in many, many companies at an all-time low. I think there is something about working in an office where with your team that allows people to derive fulfillment, stimulation, that human interaction, I think, is something that a lot of people yearn. And I suspect that as soon as executives and founders, CEOs, and C-suites return to the office, their subordinates will also return to the office, and ultimately, people will simply enjoy and prefer working with other people in person. You can't have water cooler conversations down the hallway in a work remote environment. You have to create these incredibly contrived social Zoom and video conference meetings that prove to be incredibly draining to a lot of people because through video conference, people don't get the same kind of emotional feedback and responsiveness that you have in real life. In a video conference meeting, you can't have, in large meetings, you can't have five different simultaneous conversations. You only have to have one person talking at a time. It really changes the way that people are naturally used to interacting. And I think ultimately, I don't think that will be people's long-term preferences.
Great. I 100% agree with that. So my last and final question for you, you supported, Mayor Pete during the primary. You're obviously supporting Joe Biden now. There are a lot of listeners, especially on the sort of Republican side of our listenership, that are going to agree with every single thing you just said. But can you sort of just make the case, though, for why any inherent skepticism, just for example, just as, you pointed out that Chinese Communist Party speaks eloquently about the global order and the rule of law, but when in terms of their when it comes to their action, they don't actually follow through on that. Can you sort of make the case for why, coming off of the sort of struggles that the Clinton administration and the Obama administration had with this China issue, why can we trust that this all isn't talk at a deeper party leadership level?
So I would say that yes, President Trump has put his finger early on an issue, basically identifying China as a threat before it became part of the national mainstream consensus. Two things I would note is that the first is that he wasn't the only one. So there were other people at the time that were making this case. And the second thing is that still today, even within his own party, it's not, there are a number of Republicans, as we talked about earlier, that still cling to a much more pacifist and passive approach to China. I think that so on that's all to say that within both parties, there are hawks and there are doves, and I think that it's important to note that I think that as we've seen in recent days, Joe Biden is decidedly the right candidate to really take America all the way in terms of helping reinvigorate a liberal order. I think that if the it's let's it's important to try to foresee different scenarios. The first is if Vice President Biden wins, America will shore up its alliances and forge new ties with countries like Indo-Pacific democracies like India, South Korea, Australia, and Japan. And I think that would frankly be a best case scenario, because that's happening because what's happening in the last 6 months, we as a country have a unique opportunity to build a new American moment and frankly make it clear to China that democracy should be the future of mankind, not authoritarianism. Although President Trump put his finger on an issue early on, I think it's important to acknowledge that under the scenario where he gets elected, the United States will likely continue to take on China, but will almost certainly do so mostly on its own without much coordination with other countries. And I don't think that would be a long-term recipe for a decisive beneficial outcome to American interests. I think the best outcome under this scenario would be that other democracies work together independently of the U.S. to stymie China's efforts. And the worst case scenario would obviously be that democracies end up too divided to be effective and that China successfully carves up a large part of the world under a global sphere of autocratic influence. And I think that would be a human tragedy of historic proportions. So I think the main case that I would make is that ultimately, if we want the United States to win this contest, America today, as it has in the past, will need allies. And the only type of leadership that is providing a path to forge robust alliances that are capable of actually delivering victory is the leadership that Joe Biden is offering.
Well, Jacob, thank you so much. I really appreciated this, and I wish you the best. Oh, and by the way, when is your, where should people follow you on Twitter? When is your book going to come out? Let's go with those details.
Sure. So people can follow me on Twitter at Jacob Hellberg. My book's going to come out probably sometime next year. I'm going to submit the manuscript around the end of this year, and I'm really excited because it really strikes at the heart of a lot of the topics we covered today. And so I suspect it'll raise a lot of issues that are interesting to people.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jacob.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. We'll see you on Tuesday for Sagar's Realignment Crossover with Andrew Yang's podcast, and then we'll be back to our normal format on Thursday. As I said, if there are any other big realignment issues you'd like us to deep dive on, like we focused with on China today, let us know. Drop us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com or connect with us at Twitter. And as always, thank you to the Lincoln Network and the work that they're doing to support this podcast. And a reminder that Sagar and I are going to be headlining the Reboot 2020 conference that Lincoln is going to put on after the election. We're going to focus on a lot of these big tech, populism, and national security issues that we focus on and you guys really enjoy. So I really suggest you check out rebootconference.org to see what we're up to. See you next week.